What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur, plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah, Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
Welcome in to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. We are down a legal eagle. One of his wings was clipped. Jason Whiteside not with us today, so it's just Rich and myself hanging out with you. Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Lots to get to, and we might as well just start right here. Nick Berardini directed Killing Them Safely. It's a documentary. He's actually in Columbia, Missouri right now at a movie festival. Is that accurate, Nick?
Yeah, we have True False Film Festival is one of the premier documentary film festivals in the world, really, and I'm on the screening committee. So, you know, you have a lot of hosting responsibilities when you're the local, and everybody comes into town. Everybody thinks they're 21 all over again. So it's a lot of late nights.
So, Nick, tell us about Killing Them Safely. I was lucky enough to see the film at the Chicago premiere two nights ago. That was brought to us by our friends at the Midwest Independent Film Festival. Mike McNamara is a frequent guest here on WGN. Great film festival. Tell us a little bit about the film, which, by the way, was incredible. I thought it was really well made, and encourage all of our listeners to check it out when it's released later this month on Netflix. But why'd you make it first, and what's it about?
Well, I started making it because of, while I was a senior in college at the University of Missouri, a 23-year-old young man named Stanley Harlan was killed during a traffic stop right in front of his parents' house with his parents watching after he was tasered in the chest for 31 seconds. And initially, my reaction was common sense, sort of, well, you know, these seem like safe devices, but shooting electricity in somebody's chest for 31 seconds, probably not a good idea. And so my initial focus was on making a film about Moberly and how it was sort of overcoming this police use of force. And Moberly, excuse me, was the town that he was killed in, and how it was going to piece itself back together after what had happened to him. And when I started looking at the officer's training material, there was just nothing to signify that, you know, death could be a result. In fact, it was the opposite. A lot of the training material suggested that death was impossible. And that made me curious about the only company making the weapons, Taser International. And I just went to them and said, you know, I have this thing that I'm making. I don't know quite what it is yet. Can you speak from your platform? The only thing I could sell them on was that it was open-ended. It was not, you know, these 15-minute long-form news segments, or it was not, you know, the daily news, of course, which is even shorter. This was going to be really expansive in a film. And they said yes. And so I went there to kind of seek out the way they see themselves. And this movie turned into sort of an exploration about the only company making the weapons, and in a lot of ways, how the victors write history. A lot of people assume it's a movie about tasers, but really it's mostly about the men making the tasers and the men selling the tasers, and how they, you know, sort of have justified a lot of the collateral damage in their eyes for the greater good over the course of 15, 16 years.
So speaking about the men who make these tasers, the central protagonists in the movie are the Smith brothers. Tell us how you went about getting them involved. They're not actually interviewed in the film. They're depicted through a series of speeches that they're giving to their, I won't say cult, but it sort of yeah. It sort of appears that way. It does have the feeling of you know, some kind of Orwellian meeting. You also have deposition testimony. You do have one of their you know, upper management people. Tell us about those people, and also tell us about what their reaction was when you came into their company to interview them.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, if I can brag about myself a little bit, I think the structure of the film that works so well, that is so interesting, is that there's this one day I got to spend inside the company. I was kind of hoping for more eventually, but, you know, after one day, it seemed a little clear that the interview and the shooting didn't go the way that Steve Tuttle, who's the vice president of communications at Taser, probably expected it to go. Not that it was aggressive, but you know, this guy's job. He's a multimillionaire, and his job is, you know, to protect the company's image.
By the way, Nick, let me jump in. Is Steve, just so our listeners know when they watch the movie, is Steve the person that you interviewed, the guy, you know, the blonde?
Yes.
Yeah, and he's wearing, what was notable in the film is, you know, maybe the way he dresses and maybe the way some of the other employees dress. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, he's got the, you know, the taser on the lapel and the blue on blue tie. And actually, you know, the thing that struck me so much when I walked into that place is you nailed it. It's Orwellian. It just sort of took me aback. And I think right out of the gate, you know, he was like defensive almost about the company and where it is. And I'm just this unassuming 24-year-old walking in. You know, I don't really have a set sort of idea for them yet, and just the way that everything felt so constructed as a pitch, which makes sense. Again, you know, this company's job is to only sell the best version of itself, but it didn't feel as authentic as I expected it to feel. I think they believe it. I think they believe this pitch. You know, right out of the gate in the first minute and a half of the movie, you know, Steve Tuttle calls it the American dream. And it's just like when you hear a PR guy say that right out of the gate, you're just kind of like, I don't necessarily believe you, you know. So that to me was that was the thing that struck me, was that it just was Orwellian. It is a cult, and it's an absolutist culture, and that's what became fascinating, is their ability to sort of engage with who they are versus, you know, who they see themselves as and the way they want to be. And so the structure of the movie works because it's this pitch from this company. This is who we are, putting their best foot forward. And gradually, as the film goes on, you know, we're starting to very slowly shift away from their point of view to fill in the gaps with these deposition videos and these other pieces of archive that, you know, tell the complete picture. So that's what, to me, I felt was most fascinating. It was a competition between, you know, the best version of this company versus the real version of this company. And will they be able to see themselves for who they really are at the end?
We're talking with Nick Berardini, who directed Killing Them Safely, here in Legal Face-Off on WGN+. RogerEbert.com reviewed your documentary. Nick Allen, here's a passage from what he said. Quote, Killing Them Safely is valiant at damaging a Goliath business where it counts, decimating the purpose and potential of a golden product. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think that the difference is, though, I'm not trying to attack the company in the film. I'm not trying to, you know, rush in and be the grandstanding sort of gallant documentary film hero, right? Like, the film in so many ways is just an experiment, again, to see if they will come to grips with what has happened the past 16 years. And on a human level, I don't think they can, because I don't think if they did that, they may have a nervous breakdown when they really consider the collateral damage. But of course, on a business level, what's so important to them is the trust of law enforcement. And they started with this claim at a very early point that these tasers could never kill anyone and that they were perfectly safe. And then they had to walk that back very, very slowly over the course of 15 years. And if they go any further, I think they're going to start to lose the trust of law enforcement.
Nick Berardini, director of Killing Them Safely, joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Nick, our mission here on Legal Face-Off is always to take the legal angle of current events. Speaking legally, and one thing that interested me in your movie was the one case that actually went to verdict, I believe. There might be many, but the one that you depicted in your film, that one, the jury comes back and I think awarded $6 million. And the company is very boastful, very proud of the fact that they reduced that to, I believe, something like $175,000, if I recall. Could you tell us about that verdict a little bit, and maybe some other cases that have gone to trial? Because they were very strident about fighting these cases and not settling, right? And by,
sure,
by
yes.
these cases, I mean cases brought by people who have died after being tasered.
Yes. They have used as sort of a big piece of armor that they had been very successful in all these product liability cases for a very long time. Of course, you know, anyone with a basic understanding of the civil tort system can understand how difficult product liability cases are to begin with. So, A, it's sort of a bad judgment when you look at a company's record, because it's, of course, inherently designed and should be inherently designed to sort of protect the company from a liability perspective. So a lot of these cases that, you know, get dismissed end up getting dismissed in Taser's case because of technicalities. It's not really suggesting that the weapon didn't kill the person. And yet, from their perspective, that counts as a win. So it was a bit misleading. And then what started to happen was finally these lawyers came along and found a blueprint for how to navigate the product liability system and actually become successful. So their first case was this case of Robert Heston, who was tasered for about 75 seconds over 20 times by three different officers. And what was so fascinating about that case was it proved this theory, basically, at least in court, of metabolic acidosis, where if you're tasered for that long, your blood can become acidic if the officers are pressing against your back and holding you on the ground. And the jury, despite the fact that the man, Mr. Heston, had some methamphetamine in his system, felt so compelled by Taser's recklessness that they awarded his family, I think it was like $5 million plus attorney's fees plus compensatory damages, but $5 million in punitive damages. And then an appeal that got wiped out. But what had happened was it opened the door now to sort of for these two lawyers to sort of figure out how they could navigate the product liability bar and bring additional cases. And what they started doing, which I think was absolutely a game changer, was finding cases where there were no other factors, and they changed the mechanism they were proving in court. It became direct cardiac capture leading to cardiac arrest because of the electricity of the weapons. And these cases, there's just nothing else you can say. Somebody's shot in the chest, a minute later they're dead. Nothing happens in between. And what they were able to show was that in 2006, the company knew about this risk from its own internal testing and had not warned officers about it. And that's when they started to open the floodgates a little bit, and they've been pretty successful suing them ever since.
Nick, I was curious from watching the film about the indemnification that flows from Taser to the various police departments. In other words, is there a contract between Taser International and the police departments that they sell these products to pick up the defense if the parties are sued in this kind of case? Or how's that working? Do you know?
Yeah, that's one of the great sort of debated mysteries of how the relationship is with law enforcement and Taser. A lot of agencies are under the impression that there is an indemnification. I don't believe in a lot of cases that's true. What they do suggest, what they do say they're going to offer when they sell the weapons is, you know, if something happens, we'll bring in our experts and we'll bring in, you know, everybody who can help prove that what happened was going to happen anyway. And it's sort of a ridiculous premise. So when something does happen, it's obviously, you know, in a lot of cases, it turns out to be a misuse of force, because a lot of these people who die or are injured are not in positions that their lives should be in jeopardy. A lot of times it's at passive levels of resistance when something does go bad. So A, you've already got sort of an excessive force case, which doesn't have anything to do in a lot of ways with the company, except for the fact that they're training these officers, you know, by controlling the training from the top down to use the weapons at passive levels of resistance.
Nick, Chicago is on pace to break a murder record already. It's March 4th, and it's on pace to shatter murder records. And the famous murder here is Laquan McDonald. I'm sure you've seen the footage. The cops opened up rounds on him, were shooting at him. He's still here if they use tasers instead. Was that the play? Should they have been using tasers instead of unloading rounds of gun?
For every Laquan McDonald, you're looking at thousands and thousands and thousands of sort of passive resistance or lower level resistance uses of tasers. So would you ever want to fully take tasers off the streets? Probably not, because that scenario of Laquan McDonald does exist. What we know from 16 years worth of research and numbers is that that scenario almost never happens. It's almost never used in the scenario that, that Laquan McDonald was in. These weapons are adopted under the premise that they're going to reduce deadly force by a lot of these departments, and they don't. Chicago has done this before. Chicago expanded taser use in 2009, 2010, 2011 to try to reduce shootings. Didn't work. What ends up happening, the scarier thing, is that it ends up potentially creating more use of force situations than existed before the expansion. So are tasers a good idea in a very specific circumstance like Laquan McDonald? Yeah, that could have been a really good circumstance to use it. But is that the common circumstance versus, for example, Stanley Harlan in the film, who is pulled over for speeding and eventually killed because he's using his cell phone to call his mother? You know, it's not a one-to-one comparison, obviously. The Stanley Harlan scenario happens much, much more frequently than the Laquan McDonald scenario does.
Nick, we're going to let you go. Again, I want to see the movie again after having just seen it a couple days ago. There's so many different elements that, you know, are worth checking out again. And now that I sort of have the perspective of seeing it once, I want to see it again. But I want to let you go with one last question. I got a good idea. You know, as a someone in the documentary space myself, we've worked on a couple. We've got a couple in production. I really, you know, admire what you did. But I got a good idea for a sequel. Are you ready?
Sure.
The story of that silly putty or that silly string gun that you show early in the movie, where, you know, an early attempt to have something more passive. You depict the police using some sort of silly string device, maybe,
yeah.
Or a glue gun or whatever that was.
Sounds like Spider-Man.
It was exactly like Spider-Man.
It was
like
very much like Spider-Man. Yeah.
Maybe that's the next one.
And just briefly, you know, I think it's important for me to, you know, also from the perspective of someone who knows this company now intimately, you know, I think it's really important to validate, and the film does, the idea of the weapon itself. You know, and the movie's great thesis really is that it's basically just about the ability of humans to only see the best versions of technology. We get so enamored with technology, and police departments became so enamored with these tasers because they thought it could be the solution to reckless shootings and police brutality. And, you know, we get wrapped up in that without thinking about what might go wrong. And I think that happens to all of us. I think that's a universal sort of human thing that can happen. And so that was, you know, it wasn't necessarily just malicious on the company's part. I certainly believe their altruistic, you know, idealism when they first started.
Nick Berardini, he directed Killing Them Safely. It's coming out on Netflix late March, killingthemsafely.com. You're on Facebook, too. Good luck down in Missouri, and good luck down the road.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back, Legal Face-Off on WGN+. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on iTunes as well. Jason Whiteside out today, just Rich Lenkoff in studio with me. My name is Sam Panionovich, and we've got now on the phone lines Kim Goldman, who wrote Can't Forgive, My 20-Year Battle with O.J. Simpson. She joins us now on Legal Face-Off in Chicago. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us, Kim. We want to talk to you today about your brother Ron and the O.J. Simpson series that is currently airing. I'm curious, did the producers, director of the film, the director was Ryan Murphy, who's made some other films, did they ever reach out to you to talk about the film at any point during the production?
No. Nobody from the production has reached out to us even since. We've asked to see some of the episodes so that we can prepare ourselves or watch it before the world sees it, and we've been denied our requests. Other people have seen all the episodes. I'm not sure why they get to and we don't, but so no. We were not, and we didn't expect to be. People use the term consulted. I wasn't asking to be consulted. I just would have been, I would have appreciated a heads up or a something, you know, an olive branch to be extended since they were using our story to sell their show.
Sure. So from a legal, we're a legal show. From a legal perspective, everything that occurred is pretty much in the public domain, so they have the right to portray it. But, I agree with you personally that it would have been, I think, courteous to talk to you. How does the rest of your family feel? Do they agree? Obviously, your dad was very prominent during the course of this entire event and, very articulate in speaking out on behalf of your family. How does he feel, and how does the rest of your family feel about the movie?
Let me go back and say something about from a legal perspective. Actually, here in California, as of January 1st, 2015, there was a law passed called Missy's Law that requires writers, producers, directors, whomever's writing a story or using your story for financial gain, has to notify the families that they're doing that. So it doesn't mean that the families can do anything outside of what their legal rights are, but there is a law here that requires them for the families to be notified. But just wanted to put that out.
No, that's interesting. Was your family involved in that legislation at all?
No, we weren't. The organization that started is Crime Victims United, and it was based on a story. This woman, her daughter, was murdered, and the person that committed the crime are out pimping their story, and there she's finding her daughter's story on the news, and so she talked to somebody about it, and they wrote this law to protect families from being bombarded like that without them knowing. And it allows the victims to have a voice. It allows the victims to, try to go after any victim restitution that might be owed to them. And this particular family, there were items, personal items of her daughter's that were being, her daughter's death that were being used in their program. So it is a law here in California. So I don't know that we qualify because our killer wasn't found criminally responsible, although he was civilly. So we're looking into that, but
there have been a handful of episodes, America Crime Story, the O.J. Simpson against the people. What's the biggest difference, and you've seen a couple episodes, between reality, what actually happened, and what has been portrayed so far? Anything that's blaring that isn't just accurate at all?
There's things that are, I guess for me the blaring things are what has been omitted. They had to take almost a year's worth of trial and testimony and pre-stuff and jam it all into 10 episodes. The thing that I think people should be paying attention to when they watch it is that five of the key people are dead. My brother, Nicole, Phil Van Adder, who was a lead detective, Kardashian, and Cochran, the killer's in jail, and nobody else was communicated with. So where are they getting all the dialogue? Because if they're communicating with people, then they're breaching attorney-client privilege. And so where are all these conversations coming from? So you have to know that whatever they're airing is somewhat based in truth, and then there's a whole bunch of creative license that has been added to make it salacious and sensational and make it so the sponsors want to buy advertising space during the show. So, it's hard for me because I'm watching it going, how the heck do I know if that ever happened? Because I wasn't in the hallway, during that time. So I have no idea, where some of it's coming from. But there are definitely things that didn't happen the way that I remember them. I don't know that I could sit here and put my list together, but there were definitely things that I'm like, that didn't happen. That's not what he said. That was said 5 years ago. Now you're putting it into the show, like that kind of stuff. But I don't know, the conversation apparently that we had with Marcia, my father, and I that didn't happen. But
yeah, I want to ask you about that because I watched that. I've watched every episode until the last one. I haven't caught up yet. But yeah, there's a scene where you and your dad are in Marcia Clark's office, and you're talking to her about what her plans are to prosecute. Could you tell, you said that wasn't accurate. How wasn't that accurate?
Well, I don't remember that ever happening, that conversation ever happening. Now, that doesn't mean that sometime over the course of 10 months, we didn't have a conversation with Marcia that included some of that dialogue, but I don't remember it happening like that in that setting before they even, because that scene happened before they formally charged him, if my memory serves. And I don't remember that. I just don't remember that. But, you know, if the only mention that my brother is going to get throughout the show is in that 10-second monologue that my father gave, then, you know, I guess I'm supposed to be grateful. You know, I mean, but I understand that the show is not about us. I understand the show is not about Ron or Nicole. I just don't understand what the probative value is to the show. And so I'm still trying to figure that out. And so right now I just sort of feel like people are sitting down popping popcorn watching a movie about our story. And
right.
That's rough.
So I remember the trial, you know, following it like most people did pretty intimately, even though it's been 20 or so years. And I remember even during the trial, your brother, Ron Goldman, wasn't, you know, talked about, I think, to the extent that he should have. You know, it was a very sensational story between OJ and Nicole, and that got most of the attention. Do you feel like Ron not being talked about enough during the trial is still now happening 20 years later in this movie? And maybe his,
yep,
you know, his story not being,
yep,
portrayed the way it should be?
Yep, that's been a little rough. You know, we spent, you know, most of the criminal case being upset that my brother was, you know, always referred to as her friend or, you know, a wannabe actor, wannabe model. I mean, it was very, very hard to not hear my brother's name mentioned ever. You know, that was really rough for us. And years later, like part of the reason why my dad and I are working so hard for victims' rights, you know, is because we want to make sure that everyone has a voice. And, you know, we felt like my brother wasn't acknowledged the way that we think that he should have been. And here we are 20 years later, there's a whole show about it. And my brother was only featured as a slumped dead body in the opening scene. There was a People magazine that came out a couple weeks ago that had Nicole on the front and it says Justice for Nicole. I'm like, really? What?
I mean,
are we back here again 20 years later?
From my perspective, your brother's a hero, right? I mean, he could have, for all we know, your brother could have stopped this murderer, who I think is OJ. I mean, I think it's obvious. He could have stopped OJ from, you know, going on a spree. I mean, you know, your brother could have been the one that stopped him from doing this to who knows how many other people that night or on other nights. So,
well, you know, I guess the way we look at it, and I appreciate that, you know, my brother didn't run. And, you know, if what people remember about him and his character is that in the last minutes of his life, you know, he tried to save another human being and he lost his life in the process. And if nothing else, I want that to be what people think about when they think of my brother.
Kim Goldman with us on Legal Face-Off WGN Plus. Can't even imagine what you've been through. Also, can't even imagine having to write about it. I mean, I'm thinking about things that are on the cutting room floor still. How amazingly tough is that to try and chronicle what you feel and also have to think about what happened and then put it to paper?
Yeah, you know, I've come from a therapeutic background, and so journaling has always been a big part of my life. I run an agency now that I do mental health for teenagers, and a big part of what I always tell them is to write it down, get it out of your head, because it's more manageable when you do that. So I write a lot, and so when I went down to write my memoir, and, you know, it was hard to put myself back into what I was feeling at the time, and then be able to use, you know, all these years of my maturity and I hope my maturity to be able to process later, but, you know, it was hard, but it was very cathartic to be able to do that. And, you know, I was given an opportunity to write a second book called Media Circus when I interviewed 10 families that were involved in high profile cases to kind of talk about what it's like to live your private stuff, you know, out in the public for everybody to watch. And that was also really a very cathartic process to be able to talk to others and kind of get stuff out in the open and have open dialogue about things that are really painful. So I'm just proud of that.
Kim, you were in the courtroom for what's been called the trial of the century. You've been dealing with this now for 20 years. I would venture to say that you're probably more of a legal expert on some of these issues than some of the best criminal lawyers in the country. So we'll let you go with one last question. What do you think the prosecution should have done differently in the criminal case? We've all got our theories about, you know, what went wrong. Do you think they should have done something differently? I mean, listen, from my perspective,
I think they should have had a different defendant and a different judge. I mean, honestly, it's I think it's very easy for those of us on the sidelines to be able to look, and you guys better from a legal standpoint, you know, to know what you would have done, you know, or to be able to scrutinize, I don't mean scrutinize in a negative way, but scrutinize what they did or didn't do. I honestly think that Chris and Marcia were up against something that was far bigger than anybody could have imagined. And we had things working against us that weren't facts and evidence. And emotion played a huge part in that courtroom. And a lot of things came from out of left field that took front and center stage. And the only thing maybe that Marcia and Chris could have done differently is as maybe thought more in terms of cat and mouse. I mean, I think Chris and Marcia believe wholeheartedly in their evidence. Why wouldn't they? It all pointed to one person. And I think they believed in the truth. They believed in the system and they got beat. And I will never find fault in anybody from the DA's office or law enforcement because they were the only people fighting for my brother. And I appreciate all the sacrifice and compromise and all the lives that were devastated from that. So,
Kim Goldman, sister of Ron Goldman, joining us on Legal Faceoff, WGN Plus. We can keep in touch with you, KimberlyGoldman.com. Thank you so much for your time here in Chicago.
Thanks, guys. No problem.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Legal Faceoff, WGN Plus, as we move on through here. Jason Whiteside out today. It's just Rich and myself. We've got Andy DeVote, partner of Loeb & Loeb, with us now on the phones, and he's been all over the big case in the Supreme Court. Andy joins us now on WGN Plus. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Andy, welcome back. You talked to us last show about Scalia's replacement. You served as a law clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. You also worked for Judge Michael Kenney of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Your Legal Faceoff's go-to guy for SCOTUS. So big case this week dealing with abortion that was argued. Many are calling it the biggest abortion case in 20 years since Casey. Can you tell us why this case is so important?
Sure. Well, first of all, this is a case coming out of the Fifth Circuit, coming out of Texas, and it has to do with regulations passed in Texas regarding facilities that provide different medical services, including abortion. And the two key provisions, guys, are one, this notion of there being admitting privileges, that any doctor who is at one of these facilities performing an abortion has to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of that location. The second is that any facility that provides abortions has to meet certain standards set for what are called ambulatory surgical centers, ASC. And these are different operating requirements, fire and general safety requirements, and then also physical plant requirements. And the reason this is the biggest case since Casey in 1992 is because what the petitioners are arguing and the government, the U.S. government through the Solicitor General, is that these are the most extreme restrictions placed on a woman's access to abortion. And in the case of Texas, petitioners specifically argue, basically, look, these regulations don't make abortion any safer, and they're going to result in 75% of Texas's existing facilities to be closed. And we're going to have a situation where we're not going to have the capacity to provide women access to this health care. And then that runs afoul of the Supreme Court's existing precedent. And so that's why this is the biggest case in 20 years or 25 years, because you have, you know, people weighing in. And this isn't the only state with these types of restrictions. There was a case, as you guys probably know, in Wisconsin, just decided in November in the Seventh Circuit, with this very type of these quote-unquote admitting privileges. And there are a number of states across the country that have both these types of restrictions or regulations. And so, you know, it depending on the decision, it could have national implications for the question of, abortion.
Isn't that called an undue burden when you have to travel way too far and wait longer to get the actual procedure? Because they're making it way more difficult for them to get these taken care of.
Well, that's exactly right. Under Casey, tweaked the standards slightly from Roe v. Wade, right? It upheld the premise of Roe, but then you had a three-justice plurality, one of whom being Justice Kennedy, along with Justice O'Connor and Justice Souter, that they went on to tweak the standard to say, we look at this law and we look and see the purpose and effect, and does it place a substantial obstacle on or an undue burden on an individual seeking to have an abortion? And that's exactly the question. And you've got, you know, they had oral argument this week where your point was front and center. Is this an undue burden on a woman's right to access an abortion?
And the proponents of the Texas law would argue that some recent developments since Casey warrant these restrictions, right? There was a case of a Philadelphia doctor named Kermit Gosnell, who was convicted in 2013 of murder and the deaths of three babies and one woman in an unregulated abortion clinic, right? The Americans United for Life said that this was, quote, an alert to public health officials in states to upgrade their standards. So that's one of the arguments in favor of this restriction, correct?
Exactly right. So the stated purpose of the law was to raise the standard and quality of care for women and to effectuate and protect the health and welfare of women seeking abortions. And it really touches on a key point, guys, because you were exactly right in terms of the standard and undue burden, this obstacle. But one of the key questions in that analysis that the justices were arguing over and the parties don't agree on is, when you look at the regulations, do you look at both whether or not these regulations actually effectuate the state's stated interest? Or do you just look at separately whether or not this is an undue burden on the woman and an obstacle? And the reason that matters here, guys, is because when you look at the oral argument, and it was a very lively oral argument this week, you've got four justices coming at the Solicitor General of Texas saying, explain to us how this makes women safer. And so a key question is going to be, when the court looks at this, do they just look at the burden? How burdensome is this on a woman? Or do they look at it in conjunction with, do these regulations really effectuate the interest that the state is articulating in passing the regulations?
But why wouldn't it make abortion safer to force these clinics to meet certain basic guidelines for health and safety and for the providers of the procedure to have certain privileges at hospitals? I mean, you wouldn't, I guess the proponents of the law would argue you wouldn't go in and have surgery to fix a broken leg at a clinic that wasn't meeting certain standards, and you wouldn't have your leg operated on by a doctor that didn't have certain privileges, right? So why would abortion be different?
And so it's a great point, and it's a point that is, you've got the justices arguing back and forth. Justice Alito in particular really arguing on the substance with Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer. And there were friends of the court briefs, the amicus briefs on both sides. You had the American Medical Association and others weighing in saying, you know what, but these procedures actually don't make abortion safer. And in fact, certain ambulatory surgical clinics performing certain procedures, other procedures aren't held to the same standard. And that they sound good in theory, that they're really a pretext. But you're right, there are other folks supporting the state of Texas saying that, for example, with the admitting privileges, that if someone has been given privileges, that speaks to their abilities as a doctor, and that that means that you would have a certain level of quality in those doctors. There's a real back and forth on that we could go on and on, but it's a point that both sides think they have valid points to make. And I would say the state of Texas, again, what they argue is a combination. They put the points forward that they have in terms of them thinking it increases or arguing why it increases safety. But then they also say, look, again, you're supposed to really be focused on the substantial obstacle. Is this an undue burden on women? And there are going to be enough facilities. The plaintiffs haven't put in enough evidence about that there won't be the capacity in Texas, and that they failed to show, that there is, in fact, a substantial obstacle.
Is there a justice that this case hinges on? Is there one that can just shift it one way or the other?
And also, when you answer that, Andy, tell us about how this case will be decided with a 4-4 court.
Absolutely. It's a great question, and definitely. I mean, this all eyes. If you Google this case, all eyes are on Justice Kennedy. They're on Justice Kennedy for a number of reasons. First, Justice Kennedy was one of the three justices, as I mentioned earlier, in the three-judge plurality. A plurality being, when you don't have a majority of the court. Those three justices, Justice O'Connor and Justice Souter and Justice Kennedy, wrote parts of what were the majority opinion of Casey, where they upheld the framework of Roe but tweaked the legal analysis. And as I noted earlier, you have four justices who are solidly, Justice Ginsburg, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer, going to find and argue that these regulations are a substantial obstacle and an undue burden. You have three justices in Alito, Thomas, and the Chief Justice who are solidly going to find with Texas based on some sort of combination of opinions. So you have Justice Kennedy, and it's going to go one of two ways, potentially. I guess three ways. One, it's going to be 5-3. You'll have the four justices and Justice Kennedy finding that there is this undue burden. The other possibility is 4-4 if Justice Kennedy sides with Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, and the Chief Justice. And what's really significant about that, though, guys, and I know we talked a little bit about this last time, a 4-4 ruling, it upholds the Fifth Circuit's decision. And basically, in large part, the Fifth Circuit upheld the Texas law. But a 4-4 decision, and this is key, it doesn't have presidential value on the rest of the country. It just affirms the decision. And the reason that matters, guys, and is so important, is because our own state here in Illinois, or in the Seventh Circuit, in a 2-1 decision, the Schimmel case, just struck down one of these admitting privileges requirements from the state of Wisconsin, just with Judge Posner writing the opinion and Judge Mannion with a very long dissent. And what that means is that you won't have a national ruling. So you'll have parts of the country where these rulings are okay, where these regulations are okay, and you'll have parts of the country where it's not. And, you know, that really, the point of the Supreme Court is to settle those what we call circuit splits, you know, to give national guidance on key constitutional issues.
And everything you're saying is completely accurate, and it's mind-boggling how important it is, right? Like, I don't think people understand how important this stuff is, how much it's going to affect laws of this kind. You know, it's not getting much play in the presidential election, but what you're saying is so true. I mean, there's going to be states that have regulations. There's going to be states that don't. There might be states after the election, you know, depending on the legislature, that are, you know, rushing to enact laws like this. This Supreme Court vacancy is just massive, and the effect that a 4-4 court is going to have on different laws is, you can't even, I mean, it's unprecedented.
That's right. And you know, one thing that goes to this, guys, I guess a third option, and I can't take credit for this. I was reading on, I think it was SCOTUS blog, but, you know, I didn't have the fortune to be at the oral argument. But one idea that someone threw out was, look, one of the key questions here, guys, is the petitioners say, if you keep these laws on the books, you're going to shut down 75% of these facilities, and they're going to go from having facilities that provide roughly 14,000 of the abortions that are of the 70,000 that are sought in Texas. And so one of the thoughts was that Justice Kennedy had some concern that there wasn't enough evidence in the record and in terms of the existing capacity. In other words, is this really going to be that undue burden, that obstacle that we're talking about? And he thought the record could use more evidence. But what's wild about that, guys, is if that happens, and some people would see that as the court sort of ducking the question, but if it gets sent back to get more evidence, you are going to have a situation where the presidential election is just going to explode once I think that story will get picked up. Because what it means in practice is that the next nominee, you know, the next person, whether it's by President Obama or by the next president, if it's a Republican or whoever, is going to nominate what is going to could be a fifth vote either way. And if it's President Obama's appointee, that person presumably is going to join the four existing justices. And then Justice Kennedy is no longer a swing vote on this issue. You have five justices solidly on one side of this issue. And if that happens, I think it only just stirs up the pot even more about the issue that we talked about, you know, with the Republicans saying they're not even going to have hearings. It's just going to, I think it will shine in an incredible amount of pressure on all of the political parties involved and the players if it is sent back to the lower court for more evidence.
Andy DeVote joining us on Legal Face-Off. Andy's with Loeb & Loeb, recently named a 2016 Illinois Super Lawyers. Andy practices business and appellate litigation. Just a couple more quick questions we can, Andy, if you've got a couple more minutes.
Sure.
Because this is really fascinating stuff. You mentioned this was a lively discussion at the Supreme Court this week, the abortion case that we're discussing. There's also another notable discussion earlier in the week on a seemingly smaller case involving a criminal issue, but was notable for Justice Clarence Thomas speaking for the first time in, what, 10 years? Were you surprised to hear that? What did your sources at the Supreme Court tell you about that? What was going on? Why did he finally speak?
Well, it's great. You know, so I have to tell you that I had the good fortune that when I clerked, we had a number of cases where Justice Thomas spoke with two different cases when I was there, the Virginia cross-burning case and then the Michigan affirmative action cases. So it's a great question. And it actually goes to a point that I was hoping we'd talk about, which is in the abortion case, you really could sense the absence of Justice Scalia. I wasn't even there, but just reading the transcript, right? Justice Scalia would have been all over the petitioner and the Solicitor General. Justice Alito definitely asked a lot of questions, but Justice Scalia would have absolutely been all over and doing exactly what we talked about last time.
So is this a sign of? I mean, I think what you're getting at, probably. I hate to jump in, but
no.
Is this a sign of Clarence Thomas, who is ideologically closest aligned to Scalia, maybe taking up the Scalia mantle, just as you're saying?
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, only because Justice Thomas, I think, you know, has always said, look, you guys get all over me in the media about not asking questions, but Harry Blackmun didn't ask a lot of questions. And he said, you know, his stated position has always been, I only ask questions if I genuinely want to know the answer to them, and I want to hear your answer, and I don't know what your position is. That's always been his position. I think it's possible that he felt the desire, the need to speak up, and maybe will be more active. But I don't think, you know, we're certainly not going to see, you know, Justice Thomas, you know, take on that mantle, I think, of Justice Scalia.
He would have to literally do a complete, you know, character transplant, probably. One last question, Andy. You,
sure.
Again, served as a law clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. You were intimately involved with cases like this. Take us inside the room. What's it like when a case like this Texas abortion case comes up? Is the vibe different? Are people a little more tuned in that day? Are people, you know, following things a little closer? Then what's the vibe like when you are discussing these cases back in chambers? Do you realize that this might be a huge game changer for the court? And, you know, are you acting differently? Obviously, you're going to treat every case importantly, but, you know, what's it like back in the room when these kind of cases are heard?
Sure. And I would just say really quickly, there is no question the justices are always prepared. I think I told you guys before that I can honestly say I left after clerking with even more respect with the institution. Every justice was prepared. That's not just a standard line answer. I truly, you know, was really impressed with the seriousness with which each justice in the chambers took the job. But guys, there's no question when you have a case like this that everybody brings their A game. The equivalent my year was when I had the pleasure of clerking was the Michigan affirmative action cases, the Grutter and the Gratz case. And you could just feel the electricity in the courtroom, and every justice was on it, just, you know, absolutely on it. And I remember the next day even sort of feeling like there was almost a sort of a hangover, if you will, the next day when there was some small federal procedure case. You know, just the difference in energy was palpable. And that carries over the same way with respect to chambers. You know, as I said, this is a case, guys, where there are a lot of layers to the onion procedurally and substantively. And so, you know, they're going to have conference today on Friday to take the initial vote. And there will definitely be an anticipation in every chambers when the clerks are waiting for the justices to come back from conference to tell them how people are voting and where the court looks like it's going. And then there will definitely be a lot of discussion. Even if Justice Kennedy doesn't write the opinion, there's no question that if another justice writes the majority, and if there is a majority, that there will be a lot of back and forth, a lot of discussion to make sure that opinion looks like, you know, what Justice Kennedy wants it to look like, I think. So, yeah, there's definitely a palpable energy both, both in the courtroom and in chambers.
Andy DeVote is Legal Faceoff's go-to expert for all things Supreme Court. He's with Loeb & Loeb. His info can be found at loeb.com. Andy, thanks very much for joining us. We'll get in touch with you next time there's a Supreme Court issue, which is inevitably going to be in the next coming time. So we appreciate your time today.
Great, guys. Enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Next on Legal Faceoff, on WGN Plus, we're talking to Tim Alberts. Tim is with a new company that's in the online ticket sale space called FanList. Tim, you also work for a great law firm here in the city. I think it's called something like Bryce Downey and Lenkov, maybe? Is that
right? Yeah. Bryce Downey and Lenkov, that's right.
So tell us about FanList.
Yeah, so FanList, I'm a co-founder and president. I have two other buddies, both high school buddies that are partners of mine with FanList. And you're absolutely right. It's a tech startup, Chicago-founded, Chicago-based. And essentially what we're looking to do is solve the ticket-selling problem, not for brokers who have been hoarding the secondary and primary, actually, ticket markets, but reaching out and giving the average fan the same capabilities and technology that professional ticket brokers have had for years. We're the first and only company to do this. We think it's great. The people who have used us thus far, which is an increasingly number of people, love it. They're amazed at how fast their tickets sell. And essentially, in a nutshell, what we do is for years and years, brokers developed and have been using technology where if you keep the raw concept of kayak in mind, brokers develop technology where they can list a ticket that they're looking to sell. For example, let's say a Chicago Cubs ticket. They list it in one place, one time, in a point of sale interface, and through connections with all of these literally hundreds of ticket sites. A lot of people know StubHub, but there's also Ticketmaster Plus, there's Vivid Seats, there's hundreds and hundreds of ticket sites just in this country, let alone internationally. So a broker would list his ticket in one place, and that would be auto-listed on all of these ticket sites without having to log in and manage it. And what else is cool about the technology is the obvious question is that's great, but if my ticket's listed on, you know, over 100 ticket sites, what happens when it sells on one of them? And the answer to that they developed is something called auto hold technology. So literally the instant that your ticket sells on any one of these sites, your listing is removed and deleted from all of the other sites. So there quite literally is no exposure for double sales.
Let me hold you there and ask you why this is relevant to us as a legal show. I know that we've covered on this show some lawsuits and some state investigations regarding ticket selling abuses. It's been recently reported that in New York, the Attorney General has released findings of an investigation into abuses in the live ticket industry. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so and the relevancy is that you know, Fanlist is coming at a time where we're trying to help the average fan get a level playing field when it comes to the ticket selling side of the coin. Obviously, there's efforts, as you alluded to, the new New York Attorney General trying to level the playing field when it comes to fans buying tickets as well. And, you know, look, we've all – anybody who's ever bought a ticket and tried to sell a ticket realized that it's not the easiest thing to do, and it's a problem that's been increasingly worsening, but it's never been good. And it's really interesting to see this was a multi-year investigation conducted by the New York Attorney General. His name is Eric Schneidman. Like I said, Rich, we knew that it was bad. We didn't know how bad it was. Some of the key points that they found in their investigation, the purpose of which was really just to find out how much of a stranglehold professional brokers have on the market, what kind of relationships they have, and really how we can give average casual fans like you and I better access that we deserve to tickets on the primary market instead of having to go through StubHub or another ticket site and pay these exorbitant amount of fees. So, for example, and the big thing is professional brokers use these illegal bots, right? So when tickets go on sale, and you log in, and the minute that your White Sox or Cubs or U2 tickets go on sale, you're sitting there waiting and refreshing your page trying to get tickets. While that's happening, brokers are using something called bots, and essentially all that is an automation sequence from a technology standpoint that are just scooping up all of these tickets and not giving casual fans an opportunity to get them. For example, the New York Attorney General found that for a U2 concert in 2013. A single broker using a single bot bought over 1,000 U2 tickets in less than a minute. And these bots in every state are illegal, but they have not been enforced until the report for this investigation came out. What else the report found is that over 54% of all primary market tickets in the concert space were either specifically reserved for brokers or given only broker access in pre-sales. And what that means is if you're a casual fan and you're trying to get a ticket to Beyonce or U2 or Bruce Springsteen, at the time that you're actually even allowed to go on and buy your ticket, there's only 46% of that venue's tickets still available. So you're not given a fair fighting chance.
The report talked, the New York report, the AG's report talked about 70% of tickets for concerts by Coldplay, Fleetwood Mac, 70% were reserved for pre-sales.
Right.
And, I mean, that doesn't seem fair to the average consumer.
And so how it works is, and you know, just throw out a couple of Jay-Z and Justin Timberlake at Yankee Stadium, July 2013, 71% of those tickets were gone at the point in time that, you know, an average fan tries to get in, on and buy that ticket. And even at that point now, once they're open for sale to the general public, that's when these brokers' bots start scooping up. So even at that point, you don't have a fair shot.
And some of these brokers had not were operating without licenses.
They were. And since this report came out from the Attorney General back in February, they've actually threatened to enforce these laws and criminal prosecution for the brokers that didn't have licenses. And they've settled with two of them, one for $65,000, another for $75,000, which I think amounts to just the amount that, you know, punitive damages and the amounts set forth in that law. But so, again, the whole purpose of this report is how do we give fans, who are the people actually the engine behind the artists, right? They're, it's not the brokers going to the concerts. It's the fans. It's the fans that lift these artists up to the extent that they are. How do we give those people that deserve the access to these tickets, how do we make that happen? And, you know, it was a multi-year report. I think when they rolled their sleeves up and got into it, they didn't quite know how bad it was. And some of these stats are just, you know, mind-blowing. So,
Tim, what's Illinois doing about any of this? Do you know?
Nothing currently. And so before this report came out, and actually still currently, the New York law was pretty wide open. It only required that a ticket broker have a license, which is very easy to get. And beyond that, it just said that use of these bots was illegal. But there was rampant broker use without licenses and use of these bots that weren't enforced. Illinois' law is pretty much mirrors that. But the implication here is that, you know, with a state as big as New York and the pull that New York City has, we can expect that if they pass this proposed legislation that's set forth in Eric Schneiderman's report, other states are going to follow. So we can reasonably, you know, it moves forward, but at a snail's pace sometimes. But maybe in the next 2 to 4 years, we can see some of these changes from the state legislature here in Illinois be put in place to start giving fans, you know, better access to tickets on the primary market.
How do we learn more about fan lists?
Yeah, so FanList, again, Chicago-based, Chicago-run company. You can go to www.fanlist.com. And it's important to note that FanList, it's L-Y-S-T. It's not L-I-S-T, so it's F-A-N-L-Y-S-T. A couple other quick notes. When you go to our site, you can see more about how we work, the partner sites that we are currently auto-listing people's tickets to. You can see some of the excerpts from people that have used us and had just fantastic experience selling their tickets in some instances in under 5 minutes, stuff like that. The other thing is it's really cool because what we're doing, we like to reach out and kind of implant ourselves in the Chicago, not only ticket, but sports market. And currently we're doing that by running a giveaway for Chicago opening night Cubs tickets. You can sign up for that by going onto our page and going down to the bottom, clicking on the Cubs giveaway. We're also running a New York Mets giveaway right now. And by, you know, becoming kind of a staple of what we're trying to do in the Chicago live event scene, you know, we've reached out to other people and connected with them. One person is this girl who's become a friend of ours. Her name is Molly Oliver. She's kind of had a tough road. She got diagnosed with cancer, and she is up for a vote on MLB.com to be Cubs Batgirl for a day. So you can vote for her as well as sign up for our giveaway on www.fanlist.com. Check us out. It's the best, easiest, and fastest way to sell your tickets to any live events, concerts, and sporting events.
Maybe develop an extra discount for listeners of Legal Faceoff.
We could put a promo code in for sure.
All right. Well, thanks, Tim. Tim again is with FanList. Check him out at fanlist.com. Thanks for joining us on Legal Faceoff on WGN Plus.
Thanks for having me.
We wrap up the show as we always do on Legal Face Off with the Legal Grab Bag. Tim Albertstone, studio with us, as is Brian Watercott from our sales department, Rich Lankoff and Sam Panionovich. Breaking news, actually, TMZ reporting that a knife was found buried in the OJ case, right? Was it at his estate?
Yeah, just breaking now. You know, we just had Kim Goldman, sister of Ron Goldman, on. But yeah, the story is that this weapon has been buried for years, like as if we need more evidence that OJ did it. You know, enough. He did it. You can't try him again, unfortunately, but in the court of public opinion, he's been guilty forever, and he's serving time, thankfully, for this other criminal act he did.
Are you guys up to speed?
Go away, OJ, forever.
Are you guys up to speed on the show? Are you watching American Crime Story?
I've watched every episode so far. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm, as I told Kim, I'm up to the I haven't watched the last one yet, but I think the casting is like, I sort of like, I hate watching the show because I'm fascinated, but I think some of it is terrible. Some of the writing, I think, sucks. And the casting is I hate Cuba Gooding as OJ. It's just constant whining and crying, right?
And he did his best to be in the worst shape of his life.
Oh, yeah.
Like, OJ was a huge dude.
Yeah. Tim, you watching it?
I have not, but after talking about it now and having Kim on the air, I'm definitely going to go check it out.
It's also a commercial. I wonder if the show is underwritten by, Camel, because Marcia Clark literally spends half the show smoking. And those were back in the days when you could smoke in your office, back in the glory days. Remember those?
You move the desk and there's just a line.
Oh, my God, yeah. I clerked at a law firm right after my first year of law school, and that was just when these laws were changing that you couldn't smoke indoors in the early 90s. But one guy who was, grandfathered in at the firm, he would smoke in his office, office, and it was just a cigar lounge in there. He would just walk by. There'd be puffs of smoke. But, nice. Yeah, more evidence that OJ's guilty.
Did you hear the craziness about the knife that was found and what actually had happened? Apparently, a construction worker found it in 98, gave it to an off-duty police officer. The off-duty police officer took it home and kept it.
Yeah, this will be great for my collection.
Yeah.
My personal murder scene collection.
Unbelievable. And then asked a friend who was on the force to get the DR number or whatever.
I thought it was the case number.
Yeah. The whatever they call it.
Wanted
that,
to engrave the case number.
Departmental
on the knife.
Record number.
More
yeah.
good evidence keeping by the LAPD.
Unbelievable. I can't believe it.
You'll find that on Pawn Stars in a couple years.
Yeah exactly.
Right. I still think Courtney B. Vance is killing it.
He's good.
Cochran.
He is good. Although
he's getting, really
he's
good.
A little bit too low key for.
No, see, you didn't see the last episode.
He's got to turn up the Cochran.
He goes heads so up good. In the last episode.
Full on Johnny.
He gives probably the line of the show so far, and I can't repeat it right now.
Any thought? You guys heard anything about the rumors that there's a possible link to Jason, OJ's son, and how he may, you know, there's an idea that he could in fact have done the murders. Instead
well, what
of
was he like, a teenager? He was like, what, 16, 17 at the time or older?
I think he was like 17 at the time.
Crazy. Yeah, could be. Who
Crazy.
Knows?
21 years later.
Yeah.
Another witness.
Insane.
So we'll get into the grab bag here. Erin Andrews has been all over the news. There's the case going on about what happened to her, the filming of her through the peephole and all that. And I can't even imagine what she's going through, having to relive that in court every day. You actually saw her recently, Rich. I mean, how would you characterize this case and what she's had to pretty much relive on that stand?
Yeah, no question it's been tough on her. You know, we've seen footage of her on the stand this week, very emotional, you know, explaining how this has affected her life. So no question it's been difficult. But legally, I think what the question is, and, you know, I represent a lot of hotels and have defended these kind of cases a lot. The legal question is twofold, right? It's whether the Marriott in this case, and it's only this individual hotel, the corporation was dismissed, so this is a franchise location, whether they were negligent in renting the room to her or renting the room to the guy next door to her, her stalker, the guy who videotaped her, who ended up serving 2.5 years in jail, whether they violated a duty of care to her. And then the second question, maybe the tougher one for her, I think, to prove, is that her life was affected. She has damages. And what she's trying to allege, she's asking the jury for $75 million worth of damages. She's saying that her career has been affected. That's a very, very tough case to prove, in my opinion, because when you look at her career, before 2009, she was an ESPN sideline reporter, fairly successful, fairly well-known.
She's even more successful now.
What's happened since then, right?
She's the eyes on her.
Right. She's co-host of Dancing with the Stars, big network show. Yep. She signed a big deal with Fox Sports. She's had, you know, half a dozen national endorsements. We've seen the Degree antiperspirant commercial. She does a Florida Orange Juice commercial. She hosted, like, the Country Music Awards. So not to say, and if I was the defense lawyer, I wouldn't get up to the jury and say, listen, this has helped her career, right, this horrible incident. But in actuality, when you look at it just from a pure economic basis, and that's what this case will end up being, they're not going to have an easy time arguing to the jury that that she has economic losses. Right. Her career has done better. They had Jesse Palmer, her former colleague, former Florida quarterback, who's the ESPN college football analyst. They had him on the stand yesterday. And his testimony, actually, it was a 2014 deposition that they played yesterday for the jury. And his testimony was, she did a great job before, she did a great job after. So, listen, no one thinks that what happened to her was right. What that guy did was ridiculous. But from a liability perspective, I think it's going to be tough to show that the Marriott Hotel did anything wrong because of the criminal acts of a third party. And secondly, and more difficult, is going to be to show actual damages.
We got double barrel action with a subway twist, actually. We'll start with Jared Fogle. Surprise, surprise, he's putting on weight in prison.
Yeah.
How?
You know, I guess it's
well, he doesn't walk 20,000 miles the subway every day and eat a 6-inch sub. Mm-hmm. So he's putting on pounds, racking them up.
30 pounds in the last 2 months. So
gruel.
15 years of the sandwiches. Subway diet has gone the opposite way. I don't know. I don't think he gets his choice of Subway sandwiches in jail. But, yeah, maybe that's one thing that's doing well for this scumbag.
Justice somehow.
Yeah.
And then Subway was actually in the news because they were making foot-long subs that weren't a foot long. So some people were complaining and taking pictures. Did you see the picture of the tape measure? And it was only like 11?
Yeah, there was a U.S. Believe it or not, this case got all the way up to federal court. And the question was whether the foot-long Subway actually measured 12 inches. The court actually found that it only measured 11 inches. So huge news in the world of sandwich
major
litigation.
Class action lawsuit coming where we all get an inch of a sandwich.
Yeah.
So what are the plaintiff's damages in that case?
Yeah, right.
Well,
a couple less bites over the course of a year.
You know who made out great on this? The attorneys. The judge approved $520,000 in attorney's fees. And guess what the individuals who are members of the class got? Anyone want to take a guess what the actual
if a foot
plaintiffs
long is worth
got?
$5.
Yeah, they got $500. The 10 individuals got $500. There's no monetary claims for potential members, but the attorneys made over $500,000, but the individuals got $500, which at Subway is, you know, like what?
A lot of
food. A few weeks of 11-inch footlongs.
You get a punch card for that? Or is it just like a lifetime membership? Kesha just had a battle with court. Kesha back in the news.
Yeah. You know, Kesha, actually, I'm thinking of suing Kesha because I've been using the term before I leave, brush my teeth with a bottle of Jack. That's like my go-to move always that she stole for TikTok. But yeah, Kesha is trying to get out of her contract with Sony. She has a recording contract with Sony, and she's alleging that her former producer, is it Dr. Luke, I think his name is? Not sure what kind of medical degree he has. But
yeah, they just took off.
Dr. Luke, yeah. She said that he's been abusing her both mentally, emotionally, physically, has tried to rape her over the course of many years, and she's saying that because of this condition, she should be allowed out of her contract. Sony is arguing, on the other hand, that, number one, that's not true, but number two, if it is true, there are other producers at Sony that she could work with. So lots of emotional testimony from Kesha, and lots of people like Taylor Swift and lots of others supporting her. Lady Gaga came out and supported her.
Wouldn't it look bad for Sony if they're trying to keep her? I mean, doesn't it make them look calloused?
It could. I mean, I think that is an issue. But listen, you know, they've got a contract with her. They're, of course, denying the allegations. He's come out and denied it. And actually, they played deposition testimony from Kesha from a couple of years ago where she was asked under oath whether he tried to roofie her. That was one of her allegations. She said no. The attorney asked her whether he abused her. She said no. So I think Sony has to, you know, take a stand. Of course, it, you know, doesn't look great, but I think, you know, there are other producers that Sony is arguing she could work with.
Last but not least, we close out the grab bag here on Legal Faceoff WGN Plus. We had a question into the show from Mike, and he writes, how about an update on Patrick Kane? Is this dead, criminal and civil? What are the differences? Will the evidence ever be made public? So a handful of questions there about Patrick Kane. We'll start. Is it dead? Is the case dead?
It's dead for sure. You know, the civil case could be brought up anytime, but practically because of how ridiculous it ended up, this whole story being with her mom fabricating that evidence or whatever the hell it was. Yeah, for all practical purposes, no, it's dead for sure.
And the biggest difference between criminal and civil, or is it going to civil, I guess, is the question?
Well, the state's attorney in Buffalo, or the district attorney, maybe it's called in Buffalo, was looking into the allegations. It was rape and sexual assault. He declined to do so because there wasn't enough. He declined to prosecute because there wasn't enough evidence. She has the right to sue Patrick Kane civilly, which is in civil court before a jury for damages. She could still do so. There's a statute of limitations for that kind of thing, of course. But like I said at the start of that question, as a practical matter, I think her credibility has been shot, so I don't think we'll see anything civilly against Patrick Kane.
And will the evidence ever be made public? That can't be a thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, criminally, you know, once police have evidence, they're not disclosing it, obviously. In this case, actually, some of the evidence got out somehow. But, yeah, they don't disclose evidence.
Thanks for checking in, Mike. Thanks to our guest, Nick Barrett.
And Patrick Kane, as we know, is having the best year ever, so obviously hasn't affected him.
Leading the league in points, yeah.
MVP, heart and trophy.
It, sorry to interrupt. Is anything along those lines, anything about the Derrick Rose case, remember, that was before the season even started?
Yeah, it's gone away, too. I mean, I haven't heard much about that. The woman who alleges that Derrick Rose and some friends gang-raped her at his house in California. I haven't heard.
Well, she submitted right before the deadline, remember? She had like 2 days left.
Yeah, she filed.
Statute
of limitations.
Yeah, right. By 2 years, she had to do it.
Yeah, which is common. It's really common for people to sue, to file suit the day that the statute of limitations expires. That's not uncommon. But yeah, I don't know the status of that. I haven't heard anything about it in months.
That'll close up the first episode of March on Legal Faceoff WGN Plus. Thanks to our guests, Nick Berardini, Kim Goldman, Andy DeVote, Tim Alberts. Thanks to Brian Watercutt, too, Woo-hoo. For popping in. Good to see him.
Jason Whiteside.
I
think it's the best show that Whiteside's ever done today. Would you guys agree? Biggest contribution to Legal Faceoff, I think, in our show's history.
He's back.
Thanks,
in two
Jason.
Weeks. Bring the hands around.
Enjoy Vegas.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.